Two black shapes loomed against the sky some 30 meters away. Another, less than 10 meters from us, made the earth shake, and every hair stand on end. Someone called out, "Die Malter Kreuz, mein Gott!" came ridden. Hilf! Hilf! For me, who spoke German so badly, and understood it even worse, this was a signal for everyone to save his skin. I jumped up and started to run. This, evidently, is what one should not do. Through the noise of the tanks, I could hear shouts and curses. The group had taken my action as a signal for general flight. Everyone had jumped up, and was running, shouting at the tanks with the exception of the lieutenant and one or two more reflective, prudent soldiers. Later it occurred to me that even German tanks might have machine-gunned us, taking us for Russians. Also, they might have been Russian tanks. However, we managed to make ourselves recognized, and were taken in by a detachment of the 25th Panzer Division, commanded by General Guderian. These men were extremely well equipped, and had not been involved in our retreat. They put us wherever there was room, on the backs of the tanks, where the heat of the engine burned our buttocks. No one asked if we'd eaten, and it wasn't until hours later, under the rolling fire of the Russian artillery which was raking Kharkiv, that we were served a hot, greasy soup, which we received like a benediction. It was here that I first saw one of the enormous Tiger tanks and two or three Panthers. I also saw, a few hours later, the appalling avalanche of the famous Katyushas, which poured hours of devastating fire on the German infantry advancing with appalling losses through the outlying district of Slaviansk-Kinoskov. Guderian's tanks took us right into Kharkiv, where the Donetsk battles had already been in progress for more than a week. Once again, the Wehrmacht took the battered city, before losing it finally in September, after the failure of the Belgorod counter-offensive. Dawn found us in the sand pits to the northwest of the city, where our group was gone over with a fine-toothed comb by the commandos responsible for sending men back to their original units. As they didn't know where most of these units were, the best they could do was to form the strays into new groups, which everyone wished to avoid. These new units, with no official affiliation or assignments, simply sapped the actual strength of the army as recorded by military registration and on the maps at headquarters. The men assigned to these varied and unmeasurable groups could not be fitted into any logical organization. Already classified as missing or dead by their original units, they were officially considered dead, and used as unexpected reinforcements whom there was no reason to spare. Long lines of soldiers, sitting, lying down, asleep and awake, were waiting for orders which would somehow fit them into the battle. I can still remember the look of the Donets Valley, and the river, with its wide sandbanks stretching some 8 or 10 miles back from the water. The thunder of guns reached us from the front, which was about 20 miles to the south. The German attack was moving from the north and west. With their left wing protected by the Donets, the panzer assault was driving into the Russian artillery, which had rapidly crossed the river in an attempt to follow up their counter-offensive. Now these batteries had been driven back to the river, and were unable to recross it, as all the bridges were out. In effect, the Russians had just made the same mistake as the Germans at Stalingrad, although not on the same scale. In their haste to drive us out, they had overextended their supply lines and underestimated the forces pitted against them. 100,000 Russians, of whom 50,000 were killed, were caught for over a week in the Slaviansk-Kinoskov pocket. Of course, I didn't know what had happened around Kharkiv until months later. For me, the Donets battle, like the battles of the Don and of Avchenny, was a smoking chaos, a wellspring of continuous fear, alarm and rumor, and thousands of explosions. I had just been reassigned, and was waiting for further instructions with a handful of other filthy, shaggy men, when a policeman handed me a scrap of paper. The police, like the commandos, were authorized to organize strays, and the scrap of paper purported to give us the route we must take to return to our company. It seemed that the 19th Rolbein was operating in the neighborhood, and the three other fellows also belonged to it. We cleared out as quickly as we could. The fear of being incorporated into an impromptu battalion lent wings to our feet. I have never had a very strong sense of direction, but here in this chaos of mud and ruin even a migratory bird would have lost the north. Our scrawled note only gave us the principal points to look for, which might have been recognizable to regiments camped on the spot. To us, however, in an entirely new landscape, it was almost impossible to distinguish one point from another. The rare signposts that remained on the battered streets had been twisted in the fighting, and had to be disregarded. After 1,000 false leads and 1,000 delays, we finally found our company 2 days later. In the meantime, we had been pressed into service unrolling telephone wire for an SS regiment which was mounting an attack. I still remember a railway embankment which some very young SS were charging under heavy machine gun fire. We huddled in a drainage pipe which had been uncovered in a bombardment, waiting for the SS to take the area which they did, with heavy losses. Beyond the two cement walls, the flash of mortar fire and red-hot metal fragments streaked through the air. Then the same regiment used us to supply a Haubitz battery, which had been engaged for several days in an artillery duel with the Soviet guns on the east bank of the Dunitz. We were moving the heavy projectiles from their distant depot when we ran into some men from our company, repairing a collapsed bunker. The first familiar face I saw belonged to Olensheim. "Hey!" I shouted, running to my friend, followed by the three others. "It's us." Olensheim stared, as if he'd been struck by lightning. "Another four," he shouted. "God must be with us. Laos scratched you off the list long ago. There are still 30 who haven't showed up. We thought you must have been put in one of the scrap units." "Don't mention bad luck," I said. "Where's Hals? That fellow has all the luck. Right now, he's in Trevda, being taken care of, while we dig up this damn dirt." "Was he wounded?" "A fragment in the neck." "Absolutely nothing. But he was collected along with the seriously wounded. He said he was unconscious for 2 hours. But he always exaggerates." "And Lenson?" "He's fine. He's changing a tread over there." Laos arrived, and we instinctively saluted. "Glad to see you, boys. Really glad." He shook each of us by the hand. His old soldier's face filled with emotion. Then he took a few steps backward. "Announce yourselves clearly and intelligibly, the way I taught you. We conform to the prescribed pattern with a goodwill that came from a deep sense of comradeship. But, apart from this encounter, everything looked dark. The sky was filled with lowering clouds which threaten rain, and at the four cardinal points white flashes preceded geysers of damp earth and rubble by fractions of seconds. A short time later, Lenson, who was heavier and stronger than I, lifted me bodily from the ground in his delight at seeing me again. Despite the heavy labor we had to perform, the day was colored by the joy of this reunion. 2 days later, I managed to get to Trevda, which was some 25 miles from the front. Another fellow gave me his place in the DKW he was supposed to drive, and I was able to visit Hals. I found him in a swarm of wounded men, singing at the top of his lungs. Spring had arrived at last, and the heavily wounded were cavorting between two avenues of wild pear trees. Hals was unable to curb his delight at seeing me. I was carried in triumph by men who had lost arms, who were powdered with sulfanilamids and smeared with unguents. I was made to finish the remains of all the bottles they had opened, and accordingly was not able to keep the appointment I had made with the fellow who had brought me out. After waiting for a while, he grew bored, and left without me. I was taken back much later by a driver attached to my camp. Hals made me promise to visit him again, but I never had the chance. A few days later, the doctor found him fit, and he rejoined us. Hals detested the squalid cellar where we were established, and following his lead, I volunteered for service in the motorized infantry. We were fed up with digging and acting as maid servants to the rest of the army. This decision almost cost us our lives many times, but even now, looking back on everything that happened, I cannot regret having belonged to a combat unit. We discovered a sense of comradeship which I have never found again, inexplicable and steady, through thick and thin. Part 2, The Gross Deutschland, Spring 1943 to Summer 1943, Leave, Berlin. Paula, on a beautiful spring morning, we were assembled at Treves-deux, where Hals had spent such an enjoyable time. Two other companies joined us on a hillside covered with short, velvety grass, the kind which thrusts up so thickly that each blade seems to be fighting for space, and which becomes a tall savanna within a month. There were about 900 of us. A group of officers standing on the platform of a half-destroyed truck addressed us from the top of the hill. About 20 flags and regimental pennants had been propped around the base of the truck. The speeches were very courteous. We were even congratulated for our attitude in the past, an attitude which made us feel ashamed whenever we heard any bulletins from the front. We stared at the officers with enormous eyes. They said that because of our attitude they were prepared to honor any one of us who might wish it by transferring him to a combat unit. About 20 men volunteered at once. The officers, recognizing our timidity, tried to put us at our ease, and went on talking in the same style. Certain heroic actions were described in detail. 15 more volunteers stepped out of the ranks, among them Lenzen, who was clearly born for trouble. Next, the officers mentioned a fortnight's leave, which produced at least 300 volunteers. Then several lieutenants stepped down from the platform. They threaded their way through our ranks, selecting individual men and inviting them to take the three fateful steps forward, while a captain maintained the tone of eloquent pressure. The men chosen were always among the largest, healthiest, and strongest. Suddenly, an index finger sheathed in black leather was pointing, like the barrel of a Mauser, into the ribs of my best friend, my war brother. As if hypnotized, Hals took three large steps, and the sound of his heels as he snapped them together was like a door slamming shut, a door which threatened to separate me perhaps forever from the only real friend I had ever made and from the friendship which was my only incentive for life in the midst of despair. After a moment's hesitation, I joined the group of volunteers without any further pressure. I looked confusedly at Hals, whose face was glowing like the face of a child who has just been given a delightful surprise, and who doesn't know what to say. Henceforth, my identification would be Jeffertus Ager, G. 101,010 G4, Siebzehundertbataillon, Luftinfanterie Grossdeutschland Division, Sud, G. In the evening, we went back to the squalid shelters we had already occupied. Nothing seemed to have changed. The fact that our names had been added to the infantry recruitment lists was the only difference between the life we had led yesterday as truck drivers and our new life as combat troops. We felt somewhat confused as to the attitude we should adopt, but our non-coms allowed us very little time for meditation. They kept us busy cleaning up, and restoring to good condition the weapons which had taken a beating during the last battle, a job which took several days. Everything seemed to have quieted down, although strong Soviet counter-thrusts had started several fires to the northeast, at Slaviansk. We were also used for the revolting chore of burying the thousands of men who had died in the battle for Kharkov. We were officially designated burial squad one morning at dawn. The light was so faint it was still almost as dark as the middle of the night. Laus informed us that our new job would take the place of the fortnight's leave we had been promised, and were so much looking forward to. As a rule, the Russian prisoners were used to bury the dead, but it seemed they had taken to robbing the bodies, stealing wedding rings and other pieces of jewelry. In fact, I think the poor fellows, many of them wounded but designated fit for work, were probably going over the bodies for something to eat. The rations we gave them were absurd. For example, 1 3-quart mess tin of weak soup for every 4 prisoners every 24 hours. On some days, they were given nothing but water. Every prisoner caught robbing a German body was immediately shot. There were no official firing squads for these executions. An officer would simply shoot the offender on the spot, or hand him over to a couple of toughs who were regularly given this sort of job. Once, to my horror, I saw one of these thugs tying the hands of 3 prisoners to the bars of a gate. When his victims had been secured, he stuck a grenade into the pocket of one of their coats, pulled the pin, and ran for shelter. The three Russians, whose guts were blown out, screamed for mercy until the last moment. Although we had already met birds of every color, these proceedings revolted us so much that violent arguments broke out between us and these criminals every time. They invariably became furious and abusive, shouting insults at us. They said they had escaped from the camp at Omvos, where the Russians dumped German prisoners, and they told us how our countrymen were being slaughtered. According to them, the infamous Omvos camp, 60 miles east of Moscow, was an extermination camp. Rations as ludicrous as those we handed out to Russian prisoners at Kharkov were served once a day to men reporting for labor. Men who did not work received nothing. One bowl of millet was provided for every four men. There was never enough, even for the prisoners who could work. The daily surplus were simply killed. A favorite method of execution was to hammer an empty cartridge case into the nape of the prisoner's neck. It seemed that the Russians often distracted themselves with this type of sport. I myself can well believe that the Russians were capable of this kind of cruelty, after seeing them at work among the pitiful columns of refugees in East Prussia. But Russian excesses did not in any way excuse us for the excesses by our own side. War always reaches the depths of horror because of idiots who perpetuate terror from generation to generation under the pretext of vengeance. We spent hours digging out a long tunnel which had been turned into an emergency hospital during the fighting. The surgeons had been so overloaded that the wounded had almost certainly been abandoned. A line of rough triple-decker beds extended some hundreds of yards down the corridor, each containing three blackened, stiff, and mutilated bodies. From time to time, an empty space marked the final flight of a dying man. There was no light in this charnel house, except from the electric torches which some of us had fastened to our tunics. These threw beams of horrifying illumination on the thin, swollen faces of the cadavers, which we had to pull out with hooks. Finally, one delicious spring morning, incongruous in that sad, ruined landscape, a muddy truck drove down the track to the new barracks we had moved into the day before. After a brisk half-turn, it stopped about 10 yards from the first building, where a group of men which included myself were busy removing a heap of gravel and small stones. The back flap of the truck was kicked open, and a plump little corporal jumped down and clicked his heels. Without saluting or saying a word, he rummaged in his right breast pocket, where all military instructions were supposed to be kept. He pulled out a sheet of paper which had been carefully folded four times, and read out a long list of names. As he read, he indicated with a wave of his hand that the men named should step to the right. There were about 100 names on the list, among them Olensheim, Lenson, Hals, and Sager. Feeling somewhat anxious, I joined the group on the right. The corporal told us we had 3 minutes to climb aboard the truck with our weapons and packs. Then he clicked his heels again, saluting this time, and turned his back without another word, striding off as if he were suddenly going for a walk. We ran frantically to collect our things. There was no time for conversation. 3 minutes later, 100 breathless soldiers were packed into the truck, whose bulging sides threatened to collapse. The corporal was also on time. He threw a withering glance at the eccentrically bulging packs some of us were carrying, but said nothing. Then he bent down to look at something under the truck. No more than 45 on board, he barked. Departure in 30 seconds. He took another 100 paces. We all groaned silently. No one wanted to get down, everyone had the best of reasons for staying put. Two or three men were shoved off the back. As I was right in the middle, packed in like a sardine, there was no question of moving. Laus finally took matters in hand. He made half the men on the truck get down. The remainder came to exactly 45. The corporal, who was already climbing into the front seat, told the driver to start. Laus gave us a friendly wave. We had received our final orders from him. His last smile more than made up in our eyes for all the duties he had imposed on us. Beside him, The other half of the group called out by the corporal watched with dazed faces as we vanished in a whirl of dust. This half of the group joined us 4 days later, 100 miles behind the front lines, at the rest camp of the famous Gross Deutschland Division. A large part of the division, especially the convalescing wounded, occupied the rustic Aktika camp. The division itself held a mobile sector in the Vasko-Belgorod region. Everything at the camp was clean and neatly organized, as in the Boy Scouts, only far more lavishly supplied. Aktika reminded us of an oasis, surrounded by the trackless steppe. We jumped down at the corporal's order, and lined up in a double file. A captain, a first lieutenant, and a feldwebel walked toward us. Our plump little corporal snapped to attention. These officers were all dressed with astonishing style. The Hauptmann looked like a figure from a costume party, in a jacket of fine grey-green cloth with the red facings of a combat unit, dark green riding breeches, and gleaming cavalry boots. He waved at us, and then said something we couldn't quite hear to the feldwebel, who was every bit his equal in elegance. After a short conversation with the Hauptmann, the Feld walked over to us, clicked his heels, and addressed us in a tone which at least was more agreeable than that of the corporal who had come to fetch us. "Welcome to the Gross Deutschland Division," he shouted. "With us, you will experience a genuine soldier's life. The only life which brings men close to each other on terms of absolute sincerity. Here, a sense of comradeship exists between each and every one of us, which might be put to the test at any moment. Any black sheep, anyone unsuited for comradeship, does not stay in this division. Everyone must be able to count on everyone else, without any qualification whatever. The slightest error on anyone's part affects the whole section. We want no slackers and no strays. Everyone must be prepared either to obey without question, or to give orders. Your officers will think for you. Your duty is to show yourselves worthy of them. You will now get yourselves some new clothes and throw away your stinking rags. Absolute cleanliness is the essential foundation for a decent frame of mind. We do not tolerate any sloppiness of appearance." He took a deep breath, and then continued. "When these preliminaries have been accomplished, this group of volunteers will receive their passes for the fortnight leave which has been promised them. If there is no counter-order, these passes will become effective in 5 days, when the convoy leaves for Nedrigualov. You may now proceed. Heil Hitler." It was a beautiful day. Everything in the camp seemed to be efficiently organized. According to what we'd just heard, one did not trifle with orders, but that seemed a reasonable change, after the universe of shit and horror and suffering and panic we had just come from. And then there were our passes. Hal's was jumping with delight, like a young goat. Everyone felt overjoyed. Our plump corporal had one more nasty surprise in store for us. But we were all in such a good humor nothing could ruffle us. He ordered us to wash our filthy clothes before turning them into the supperly store where we would draw new ones. We found ourselves transformed into washerwomen, standing stripped to the skin in front of long troughs. Our underclothes were caked with filth, beyond hope of recovery. I kicked my shorts into the air, and tore my undershirt into shreds. My last pair of socks, which I'd been wearing since the beginning of the retreat, were nothing but holes and joined my shorts. Then, stark naked, we walked across the grass to the store, to hand in our old clothes, which were soaking wet but neatly folded and receive new ones. Two women soldiers nearly choked with laughter when they saw us coming. "Hang on to your boots," shouted the sergeant, who was not particularly amused by the sight of naked boys. "No new boots here." We were given a fresh issue of everything from caps to first aid kits. However, certain indispensable items were missing among these: underpants and socks, which in the long run proved to be serious omissions. But our spirits were too high to be disturbed at the time. When we were dressed, we were directed to a wooden army barrack. A notice in large, legible characters was tacked beside the door to remind us of the cleanliness which was officially obligatory. "Ein Laus, der Tod." A louse means death. The plump little corporal who had accompanied us from Kharkov waved us inside. We looked curiously around our new room, which was rough but impeccably clean. "Rua, mensch!" shouted the corporal. We instantly fell silent. "Since there isn't a non-com here, I am going to put one of you in charge." He worked his way through our ranks, with his eyes half closed, as if he wished to surprise his choice, who of course would not want the responsibility, or as if the decision were somehow significant. Finally, with a sharp cry, he selected a fellow who didn't seem to have anything special about him. "Do," the man he pointed to stepped forward. "Your name?"
"Wiederbeck."
"Wiederbeck, until further notice, you will be responsible for the order of this room. You will go to the Wehrenlicher to pick up the divisional patches which everyone must sew on his left sleeve. You will also," he enumerated a list of duties, each of which made poor Wiederbeck's head droop a little lower. A few minutes later, we each received the famous insignia of the Gross Deutschland Division, with its divisional title in silver Gothic letters on a black ground. This band remained on my sleeve until 1945, when the rumor ran through our scattered ranks that the Americans were shooting any man wearing a divisional name instead of a number. And at that moment of hasty judgment, they might very well have shot a nobody from the Gross Deutschland or the Brandenburg as easily as a hero from the Leibstandarte, or the Totenkopf. But that time was still far in the future. We were then in the spring of 1943, on the territory of a conquered country. The weather was marvelous, and as a finishing touch we all had 2 week passes in our pockets. After everything we had been through, this new life seemed like a dream. Except for morning and evening roll call, we were free to wander about and entertain ourselves as we pleased. Aktika was a curious place. Between the houses or groups of houses, which were built in an agreeable Russian peasant style, the grasses and wild flowers of the steppe grew with vigorous abundance, making a kind of thick lawn, which was often nearly 3 feet high. These plants and grasses, which all turned brown at the end of summer, were scattered with enormous daisies and a variety of aromatic plants which the Russians collected for seasoning their food and preparing drinks. Fields of rough, light green gherkins were set off by enormous sunflowers. The groups of houses were inhabited either by members of a family, or by friends, who built in clusters to reduce the effort of paying visits. The Russians, especially the Ukrainians, are very gay and hospitable, and ready to celebrate almost any occasion. I remember several pleasant gatherings at the homes of these enthusiastic people, during which everyone managed to forget the rivalries of the war. And I remember the girls, shouting with laughter when they had every reason to hate us on another human scale altogether from the affected Parisian beauty, obsessed by her appearance and her cosmetics. Each group of houses also had its own burial ground, which was never a sad place, but always a beautiful flowery plot, with wooden tables where people often sat and drank, and an ornamental signpost with an affectionate variation of the place name, "Beautiful Aktika, our town, Aktika, sweet Aktika." 4 days after our arrival, the second section of our group of volunteers joined us. It seemed they really had to sweat to make it, almost the whole journey had been on foot. At last, on the fifth day, we took our places in the convoy for Nedrigolov. Our passes would not become operative until we reached Poznan, which was another 1,000 miles to the west. After that, there would be 600 miles to my parents at Wissembourg. I would therefore be traveling for several days. We drove across a huge expanse of country which was absolutely flat without the slightest trace of hillock or hollow. Here and there, we could see military tractors being used for agricultural work. We were able to maintain a decent speed as far as Nedrigoilov, on a road which had been rebuilt by the army engineers, and which, every 3 or 4 miles, was littered with the wreckage of hastily abandoned Soviet materiel. We had driven for about 150 miles when our attention was attracted by some tiny shapes outlined against the distant sky. Their black silhouettes were marked by little white clouds, and the sound of explosions. The 2 trucks ahead of us slowed down, and then stopped. As usual, The Feld responsible for the convoy jumped down from the first truck and stared through his field glasses. As usual, we waited for an order before plunging to the ground. Everyone was quiet, watching the Feld attentively, trying to fathom his reactions.